Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Your diet's the same, you get enough sleep, and you're just as active as ever, but you're packing on the pounds, particularly around the torso, and by the way, you're female. So what gives? Scientists are studying a single hormone that may be the culprit. Joining me now is osteoporosis researcher and director of clinical and translational research at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, Dr. Clifford Rosen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here. My wife's from Dayton, so it's great to be in Ohio again, sort of.
The hormone that we're talking about is called FSH, short for follicle stimulating hormone. What does it do?
So we've known for a while that it's produced in the pituitary gland, and it regulates the amount of eggs that are produced by the ovary. And so it's really important, critical for reproduction. Particularly in females, that is the major driver of ovulation. But what's interesting is as you go through menopause and your production of estrogen starts to decline, the FSH level goes up. And it's quite high. In fact, we just finished a study in Iceland, and the levels are really about 8 to 10 times normal. Now, we've always thought of this as just the normal response of the body to the lack of female hormones. But we're now wondering whether that FSH that's so high is actually doing something to other organ systems. And we know from work from the NIH that bone loss is at least partially due in menopause to this driving of FSH on the bone cells. And so our concept was that maybe FSH was also doing something to fat cells as well.
So a lot of people might be interested in it because of the fat issue,
right. But
the bone density issue is possibly even more critical?
Well, I think they're both sort of equipotent in terms of impact. So long-term, bone loss is going to lead to fractures and definitely impair quality of life and also mobility. And in later life, obviously, where you live and how you how mobile are you. The obesity is more a more subtle thing, but in fact, can it lead to risks of cardiovascular disease and stroke? So they both sort of portend sort of negative health outcomes after menopause. And of course, that's why many years ago people thought, oh, well, we'll just give estrogen because that will fix everything. And we now know that that obviously is not the case, and that it has also some long-term side effects. So we're trying to investigate how else we can sort of get the body to fix itself without doing anything too negative.
Yeah. Your colleague in New York was the first to look at whether the reproductive hormone FSH was believed to be the trigger in the loss of bone density. You were skeptical about this at first. Why was that?
I think you're always skeptical when something like this comes up and nobody's ever done it before or talked about it before. And you say, somebody must have thought of this before. And so that was my original skepticism. And then some of the early data, we just weren't sure that it was real. First of all, it's mouse. And, of course, translating to humans is always difficult. But just the subtleties of the experiments, we wanted ourselves to test it out. And so over a 2.5-year period, we became somewhat believers. We said, wait a minute, this works. You know, we gave mice a high-fat diet, cafeteria diet, 70% fat, McDonald's plus for 6 weeks. And then we gave them the antibody to FSH. And sure enough, they didn't gain any weight at all.
How does a mouse appear when we're talking about midriff bulge?
So it's interesting. Mice are very similar to humans in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
First of all, when they stop making estrogen, they also gain weight. And this is not uncommon. But they don't do it till much later in their lives. But they have the same components of fat in the midriff, in the what we call the visceral fat, that we have. And when you feed them a high-fat diet, that's where all the fat goes. And what's cool about the mouse is that it's more readily adaptable to conditions than is humans. So if you can get them to change, they'll change rapidly. And one thing they do is they can burn fat. If you can make a switch, you can change them from storing fat the burning fat. And that's what everybody wants to do in humans. How can you make that switch? What can you turn on to change a storage fat to a burning fat?
A New York Times article. Well, I wanted to switch to the issue of physical activity. How did that play into the research on the mice?
Well, so they I think they felt better about themselves. They were
It just made them feel happier. Okay.
Yeah. One thing people don't know about mice is they like a better environment. It's not just a simple cage, but if you put a wheel in there, or if you put a house in there, or you put other mice in there, they're much happier, and they don't gain as much weight, and they feel better about themselves. And in this case, they actually were exercising more. Now, mice run about 5K a day. That's about 3 miles a day, mostly at night, which is something you wouldn't be surprised about. So if you put a wheel in their cage, they will run, and they were running more, which was interesting. So we weren't sure whether the FSH was also tricking the brain into thinking, boy, I feel better. I better start running some more.
Then as far as physical activity in general and how it affects weight in humans, a New York Times article from 2016 reported that strength training exercise does not help build strong bones. Other studies say it helps. I certainly am a devotee of it for the bone issue alone.
Right. So, you know, it's not magical thinking, but it is this concept that if you do this, you're going to get better. And our expectations are so high about exercise. So I've run many marathons, and I run every day. And you think, boy, I feel better, and da-da-da-da. But when we look at the skeleton, it's important to load it with physical activity. There's no question. But we don't get any kind of magical boost from it. It's not as if we can build our bone density again. What we do is we're probably just able to maintain what we have. And that's not bad. That should not discourage anybody because we're all losing bone as we age. But it's not, you know, I think our expectations are so high that we're going to do this and then our bone density will get better and, you know, we won't fracture. And so far, we just don't see that signal for a marked increase in bone mass. But I think it does preserve what you have.
I might have read in preparing for this, or I'm just making it up, or I read it somewhere else, but that it's actually something, bone density is something that we really ought to be thinking about in our youth. That's when you can make the most of a difference.
That's exactly right. So the coolest studies are the studies of young girls between the ages of 5 and 10, where they jump off a very short platform, and they load their skeleton, and you can see a 3, 4, 5% increase in bone mass above and beyond what they're growing and acquiring in their own right. So we do know that there are some exercises done when the skeleton is still young that will build bone, and that would be great if we could do it throughout life. But the skeleton is, you know, once it gets to maturation, once puberty is finished, the skeleton goes into a much more quiescent or you know, maintenance mode. And so it's much harder to build that bone after that stage.
So what's the next step after you've studied the effect of FSH on mice?
Yes.
Where does this take us now?
So what's really interesting, so we have a two-pronged approach. One is, because we're always somewhat skeptical of our own results, we're doing more studies with the same antibody to establish that this was not just a case that happened at two different institutions, but we can replicate it in other institutions. So that's going on. But Dr. Zaidi in New York has developed an antibody for humans. And so over the next 5 years, it's likely that that will be tested first in mice and then in humans. And then the other thing we're doing, which I think is kind of interesting, and we just got some very provocative results, is we're starting to study populations that have already been analyzed for fat and bone and muscle and going back and testing their FSH levels and seeing if they relate to the changes in fat mass. Because there's a lot of studies that have gone on, but it's just that nobody's really looked at that relationship.
That they might have taken those, measured those levels, but... Okay.
Yeah, but they never did anything. So we just finished a study in Iceland. We're very excited about it. And we think we had 500 plus women and men, and we're looking at FSH versus fat mass. And So that's really exciting, because even though it's not causal, in other words, it doesn't actually say that this causes this, what we can say is guilt by association.
Uh-huh.
So,
there's
yeah.
a correlation.
Yes, a correlation, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Is this clearly more of an issue for women than men?
Yeah, you know, it seems to be, although, you know, men also gain a tremendous amount of visceral fat. I'm sure if you walk down the street and you look at some older men, they have their bigger sort of, you know, pot belly mm-hmm. that's bad fat. But whether that's related to FSH or not is less clear. So one thing that was very interesting is that we found that the FSH levels in men were more directly related to their estrogen production. So I don't think people appreciate, but men make estrogen too, and that's probably a good hormone for them, but it's not as much as testosterone. And it seems to be very important for the skeleton. And it could be that they have more estrogen in old age than do women, and that's why their skeletons are a little more protected.
When you talk about, you know, running the tests and doing these studies on humans,
yes.
you have to consider, though, everything you know about FSH and what changing the levels that
That's
occur
right.
naturally, what the ramifications of that might be, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the major message. That's why until we get all our data in and we do a lot more studies, doing it in humans is going to take time. And you have to sort of appreciate all the nuances that might go with changing the FSH level. But, for example, the normal level in healthy premenopausal women is in the 5 to 15 range. In postmenopausal women, it's up to 70 or 80.
It's typical.
Yes, it's very typical.
Jeez.
And so the question is, if you lower it a little bit, is that enough? And do you need to bring it down to young people's levels? And the answer is probably not.
Yeah, in other words, maybe there's a reason for that
yes.
you just don't know yet.
That's right. That's
huh.
right. Yeah.
Well, that
so
little Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. right. Is there a lot of demand for this as our population ages?
Oh, yeah, huge demand. I mean, I think obesity and osteoporosis are some of the two biggest non-cancer-type health problems that we have. And what we're finding, and we've been talking about this for about 10 years, is that there is an association. The fat cell comes from an early cell which also makes a bone cell. So your body has the choice of being a bone cell or a fat cell. And trying to understand how that cell turns into one or the other is really important, because it's potentially relevant if we can make less obesity and more stronger bones.
What's the significance that it's one of the oldest cells?
Well, I think what it means is that it's been around evolutionarily for many, many years, and so it has multiple functions. And that's what we're beginning to find out, is that these cells, when we put them in culture and we grow them up, we can actually look at how they behave and what they use for fuel. It's so interesting. We now have the tools, so we can see how they like sugar. These cells, bone cells, love consuming sugar.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, 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 right.
Yeah.
And they're not as much, they don't like fat as much. On the other hand, the fat cells love fat. They love to bring it into their cell and then store it. And so if we can understand how those choices were made, and that was an evolutionary process, that is another mechanism of possibly changing what they
well,
become.
An evolutionary process, a good positive process, I suppose, to survive things like famine and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. So these cells can adapt readily. The downside, because you're always talking about all the other sort of off-target things that could happen,
mm-hmm.
the downside is cancer cells love mm-hmm. glucose. This is what makes them grow and metastasize. So there's got to be a fine balance between what you're using and why you're using it. So, but that's why cancers grow so fast, is because they consume mega, mega amounts of sugar.
Which we like to consume.
Yes, which yeah. we like to consume. Right.
Right. Dr. Yeah, Clifford right. Rosen, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Okay. It's a pleasure talking to you. Good luck, Ann.
Dr. Rosen is an osteoporosis researcher and director of clinical and translational research at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nationwide Children's Hospital recently broke ground for a facility dedicated to children and adolescents with behavioral health conditions. The planned 9-story building will support 48 inpatient beds. We're talking about why the facility is needed and best practices for designing mental health facilities. Joining us by phone is the architect and principal of Architecture Plus in New York, Frank Pitts. Frank is an expert in psychiatric hospital planning and design and involved with the planned new pavilion at Nationwide. Welcome to the show, Frank Pitts.
Hi.
Also with us by phone, Chief of Behavioral Health and Psychiatry at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. David Axelson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam.
Why the need for this new building, which will be named the Big Lots Behavioral Health Pavilion?
We are noticing that there's been a significant increase in the number of kids presenting to our emergency and crisis services for acute behavioral health problems, suicidal thoughts, depression, mood problems. And so in talking with the rest of the community, there was a consensus that we needed a facility that could integrate crisis care, inpatient care, and other levels of care for kids with behavioral health conditions.
Is there any template out there for how to do this?
It's relatively unique for a children's hospital to be engaging in this endeavor. We were able to consult with other facilities and very generously places like NYU Bellevue have some similar aspects to their facilities in trying to integrate care and provide great crisis services as well as inpatient services. So we have a little bit of templates out there, but pulling this all together at such a size, especially on a children's hospital campus, is unique to Nationwide.
Frank Pitts, how does the focus on children and adolescents change the equation for you as an architect in designing something like this?
The real challenge in that regard was to make this building look and feel and have an experience that was just like everything else at Nationwide Children's, while at the same time taking care of making it safe and making it effective and in treating folks that have a psychiatric illness. So that's what we set out to do.
And Dr. Axelson, design is critical to the component. It's critical to the new building. What can you tell someone like Frank Pitts about what you need when it comes to kids?
So I think that we want the facility to be engaging, to be bright, to have, as Frank said, some of those same wonderful features that the rest of Nationwide Children's Hospital has as far as design. But also really, when we're dealing with kids in crisis with behavioral health and psychiatric conditions, we also need to maintain their safety and the safety of staff and their families. So putting those two together can be a challenge that I really think that Frank and his team have successfully met in a tremendous manner.
Frank Pitts, what are the design challenges in something like this? It's not just, we're talking about a nice place. Children's Hospital is a beautiful place. The redesign is fantastic. But what are the challenges when it comes to behavioral health care?
Well, one first and foremost is having the building and the experience, the care experience, not feed the stigma that's associated traditionally with mental illness. And that's important to us because we want parents and families to bring their kids in. And for a lot of folks in a lot of places, stigma gets in the way. So first and foremost was, let's do something that looks and feels like everything else at Nationwide and get around the stigma problem. Second problem is that some kids, unfortunately, are suicidal and capable of hurting themselves. And so it was a challenge to set the building up in a way where there was adequate and appropriate supervision, but a sense of privacy, and where the things that kids could use to hurt themselves are eliminated insofar as possible, and to do it in a way where it didn't appear to be institutional. And that was a very large driver for us.
I guess a real classic example, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but are just the linens, the bed linens. Dr. David Axelson, I mean, things as simple as that that we take for granted can become part of the problem.
So certainly, and Frank's team has really been terrific in looking at this, is looking at make sure that there aren't places where a child can or a teenager could use to hang themselves, so ligature points in particular. So we're talking about door locks and the ways doors open and bathroom fixtures and things like that. Making sure that walls are designed and ceilings are designed in an effective and strong way. So really, thinking comprehensively without having, and these are things that you sort of take for granted that, as you mentioned, Anne, that you wouldn't have to think you'd need to consider. But in doing that, making sure that it doesn't have that institutional feel, because for it to be therapeutic, and especially for kids, you want it to have a certain warmth and feel like that they're in an accepting place, and that has therapeutic value. Yet also allow it to be durable, and also allow the kids to be active within the space. Certain special design features like our rooftop play deck. So we're going to be able to have kids be able to get outside on a regular basis in a safe environment is going to be really key.
We're also providing some outdoor space at a roof deck at an intermediate level that staff and family can use to get out to for being in the sun and with nature, and it provides a great view from the inpatient units for the kids that are inpatients.
Go ahead.
And things like that are actually important to achieve the therapeutic environment, to reduce stress levels, to allow staff and kids to get on with the really hard work of therapy.
Frank Pitts, how do you get to be an expert in designing psychiatric hospitals?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You do it. I worked with kids. I worked with kids when I was putting myself through college, and I got fascinated by the relationship between environment and what was going on with the kids. And so I guess I've just been preoccupied with that relationship my entire working life. And somehow the world brought us a bunch of psychiatric hospital work to do. So
yeah,
it's all I do right now.
What do you make, though, Dr. Axelson, of this, the increase in cases coming to Nationwide Children's of children, adolescents, children and adolescents with psychiatric problems, with mental and behavioral health problems? Where is this all coming from?
Well, we're honestly not entirely sure, Ian, and this is really a national trend.
Yeah.
So, tragically, for instance, suicide is the second leading cause of death for kids ages 10 to 19, and the rate of completed suicide has gone up 53% since 2007 across the country. It's presentations to emergency departments for behavioral health reasons have more than doubled over the past 15 years. So, it's really a national problem that we don't have really clear understanding why it may be going on. We have some hypotheses or theories about, whether there's things in the environment, stress, social media, hyperconnectivity, smartphones, things like that may be contributors, but there isn't any hard data to prove that.
Is that a component of the Big Lots Behavioral Health Pavilion to also study that and understand what what's behind all this?
That's correct. So we are specifically going to have space for research, and our Center for Suicide Prevention and Research will be housed there. And we're looking at some of the causes and correlates of teen suicide and better ways to identify, prevent, and treat these kids, as well as look at epidemiological factors that may be associated with this.
Is it safe to assume that a certain number of these kids don't want to be there? And how, I was wondering how that plays into the design, Frank Pitts.
Yeah.
I mean, so assuming anyone's sick doesn't want to be in a hospital anyway, you know, but meaning they don't want to be treated.
So some of the units will be locked, and the not being wanting to be there is not unusual. What we're doing, though, is to try to create an environment that reduces stress, and in that process gets kids ready to be treated, and gives staff an environment in which they can watch kids and interact with kids across a range of different kinds of activities. So, for example, the kids, every child has their own bedroom. And that's, once upon a time, was very unusual, but it's very important to setting the stage for a successful treatment venue. The children are going to be living in small residential apartments of 8 to 10 kids per, and that's also shown by research to reduce aggression and stress levels. And then they'll come out of those apartments into a treatment zone that's on each residential unit. And so it's like going to school. And so they get this experience of being at home, you know, or a surrogate of home, mm-hmm. With a smaller group of people, going to school for treatment during the day with a larger group of people, and staff gets to see them in both of those kinds of environments.
Dr. Axelson, why the 48 inpatient beds? I mean, what's the magic in 48? How did you land on that number?
Well, it is hard to estimate need. We certainly know that there are times where we don't have sufficient beds, especially in the fall, winter, and spring. And so estimating on, you know, kids that we've had to hold and wait for beds, we came up with this as our best informed estimate of what would be appropriate. You know, certainly inpatient hospitalization is not, not the only aspect of this building at all.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very large psychiatric crisis center where we're hoping to, assess and manage and treat kids in a brief fashion and really get them back out to the community without a hospitalization. We also have a 16-bed Youth Crisis Stabilization Unit, which is generally a 2 to 4 day observation stay, very intense therapy, which is different than sort of a traditional inpatient psychiatric unit, really looking to get kids linked up with outpatient and intermediate levels of care.
What's the significance of fall, winter, spring, the uptick in that score? Is it school? Is it weather? Is it what?
It seems to be probably more correlated with school and the stress that might be associated with that, and that's pretty typical for most pediatric psychiatric settings as well, that those are times of higher demand.
Hmm. Lighting in hospital has always been an issue. Frank Pitts, how does lighting impact patients? What do you know about that?
We're actually, this is going to be mostly an LED lit environment, and we're using a lot of natural daylight. So first and foremost, it's have as a lighting volume and color that's as natural as possible. So during the day, a lot of natural daylight. Almost all of the lights inside the facility are LEDs that are color balanced, and in every patient bedroom at their desk is an LED light that is programmable to change color over the course of the day. So much like the head wall lighting at the main hospital building.
Hmm. And what about light is in terms of treating patients, Dr. Axelson? How does that matter?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly evidence, especially kids with mood disorders are having problems with their circadian rhythm regulation. And so having as much natural light as possible and setting up a consistent schedule for them of light, wakening, activity, and then darkness is important. The other thing is we notice, in the wintertime, oftentimes as there's less light and it's shorter period of time, that can affect folks' moods. And so mm-hmm. keeping things as bright as possible, we think can be helpful.
Frank Pitts, what are you learning from designing a facility for adolescents and teens? What are you getting from this? What are you gathering in terms of knowledge?
I think that what Nationwide is doing is setting a standard for all urban psychiatric hospitals, not just for kids.
Mm-hmm.
The integration of inpatient service, outpatient service, crisis service, transitional housing, bridging services, research. There are only a handful of psychiatric hospitals in the country that do all of that, and so the commitment that Nationwide and Columbus are making to this model is both breathtaking and heartening, and I think it's going to be a model for the rest of the nation, not just for kids though.
It is a big deal. And Dr. Axelson, I wanted to ask the same question of you. What have you learning as you move through this process about what you want to do?
Well, it is always evolving about what is going to be, how we want to provide sort of the best care and sort of the right level of care at the right time for the right patient. So for instance, as we started this project, we originally didn't have what we might call a partial hospital program, which is a day program for kids, oftentimes staying there, 5 days a week for 2 to 4 weeks. And we realized that was sort of a need in our system of care. And so, added that to the design. So, and we do have a fair amount of what we might call shelled space or sort of space that's not programmed right now that's ready for us to sort of adapt, as we sort of look into the next decade of treatment for kids. We were able to travel to several other great facilities, Johns Hopkins, Colorado Children's, for instance, and learn from one of the facilities up in Worcester, Massachusetts that Frank designed to really learn about, where the state of the art is and include the best features of that into this current design. Fortunately, it's been amazing. We've been able to do this in large part to the commitment of the Nationwide Children's Hospital Board and the senior leadership, as well as the generosity of the Big Lots Foundation to support this effort, as well as the rest of community fundraising to allow us to build such a great facility.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Axelson. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
It's Dr. David Axelson. He's Chief of Behavioral Health and Psychiatry at Nationwide Children's Hospital, where they are building a new pavilion. It's called the Big Lots Behavioral Health Pavilion. Also, Frank Pitts, thanks to you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
Frank Pitts is the architect and principal of Architecture Plus in New York and an expert in psychiatric hospital planning and design. And, of course, he's very involved in the design of the Big Lots Behavioral Health Pavilion. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Americans consume olive oil more than ever, especially since the benefits of Mediterranean-inspired diets have become more well-known. Swapping olive oil for butter is widely recognized as a way to make snacks and meals healthier. It's been linked to lowering the risk of diseases from breast cancer to Alzheimer's. The Mediterranean liquid gold sounds almost too good to be true. Jamie Coff, senior editor of the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, recently wrote about olive oil and other health news. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Olive oil is 100% fat, no matter what. What sets it apart from butter?
Well, so the big difference between olive oil and other vegetable oils and butter is that all of them are basically all fat, but butter is mainly saturated fat, which is the type that we now know is unhealthful. It contributes to artery hardening and to heart disease. And it's been linked to a variety of other problems, too, but the main risk is to the heart. Whereas unsaturated fat, like olive oil and other vegetable oils, are actually good for us in moderate amounts.
You said olive oil and other vegetable oils a couple times now. I mean, is olive oil better than other vegetable oils for some reason?
Well, that's where it gets kind of interesting. So olive oil has gotten a reputation of being the healthiest of the plant-based oils. And one reason for that is that it's a main feature of the Mediterranean diet, which all of us have probably heard a lot about at this point. And that's really a whole eating pattern that has been linked with reduced risk of heart disease, stroke, cognitive decline. Like, it's been linked with a whole bunch of benefits. So olive oil is a key feature of that eating pattern, but that eating pattern also includes other healthful foods like fruits and vegetables, moderate amounts of red wine or other alcohol, and lots of some fatty fish and lots of really healthful plant foods. So it's like a whole constellation of foods. When you look at olive oil in isolation, it doesn't really come out as better than other vegetable oils. And in fact, some of the other oils are more linked with lowering of bad cholesterol than olive oil.
It tastes better, though.
It tastes better, really, than pretty much all of them. So that's one other very good reason to eat it. If it's your favorite oil, definitely use it, but not because you think it's healthier per se than avocado or peanut oil.
What's the difference between virgin and extra virgin olive oil? Does that make a difference?
It just has to do, it's really a quality consideration. It doesn't have, doesn't make a difference in terms of the healthfulness of the oil, but the more virgin it is, that just refers to when it was pressed. So the oil is extracted when the olives are pressed. So on the first pressing, that's extra virgin. Subsequent pressings are virgin. And then after that, sometimes you'll just see olive oil at the store, and that's fine to buy if you're going to use it for high temperature cooking. But for flavor, it's not going to match the extra virgin, not even close.
My guest is Jamie Coff. She's senior editor of the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Talking about olive oil right now. If you have a question, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that an important Spanish dietary trial called PREDIMED trial was designed to determine the long-term effects of the Mediterranean diet. What did it find?
Well, it found just a whole wealth of benefits to the Mediterranean pattern of eating that I was mentioning before. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the trial was done in Spain, and the participants were divided into three groups. One group ate the Mediterranean diet plus an additional tablespoon of olive oil daily. A second group ate the Mediterranean diet plus an ounce a day of nuts. And then a control group ate a lower fat diet, but that didn't have the extra olive oil or the different nuts, but was still basically Mediterranean in its pattern. And various studies have come out of this large trial. But the first one to come out showed that the olive oil and the nut groups both had fewer cardiovascular events over the follow-up period than the control group. And then more recently, follow-up studies on the same data have linked the Mediterranean diet with olive oil, the one that had a little extra olive oil in it, to a whole variety of benefits, from reduced risk of cognitive decline and breast cancer to reduced risk of fractures from osteoporosis. The caveat here is that it's uncertain how big a role the olive oil alone played, since even the control group ate almost as much olive oil, about 3 tablespoons a day, as the olive oil group, which just had that extra tablespoon. And we also don't know how other oils might have compared if people had added a little extra of other healthful plant-based oils that have that healthful unsaturated fat.
Besides olive oil, what are some other, is it vegetable-based? Is that the other major component of a Mediterranean diet?
Mediterranean diet pattern includes olive oil, lots of plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, legumes, as well as moderate amounts of fatty fish, moderate amounts of alcohol, especially wine, and sort of small amounts of nuts and the olive oil that we mentioned. So it's this whole constellation of plant foods and some fatty fish.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air with Jamie Coff of the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I had read a book a few years ago called Extra Virginity, and it was all about the worldwide trade in olive oil and how olive oil gets altered with other oils because they are less expensive, and therefore you're not getting true benefits of 100% olive oil. Did you look at that?
We didn't look at that in this particular article, but we actually did another article last year in 2016 on food fraud, and our sort of poster child for food fraud in that article was olive oil.
Wow.
You're spot on. There's a disturbingly large percentage of imported olive oil in the U.S. that, as you mentioned, Dan, is actually diluted with cheaper, highly refined oils, often soybean, corn, or canola oil. It's sometimes also adulterated with hazelnut oil, but more often it's the soybean, corn, or canola, those cheaper refined oils. And the problem's actually gotten so rampant that the USDA has tried to intervene with adopting new standards for olive oil, how it's labeled and how it's graded, but the standards are voluntary, so not all manufacturers follow them.
I would imagine that the countries of origin have a stake in this as well, though, right?
They do. And actually, there is something that you can do when you're buying olive oil. You can look at the labels, and on international olive oils, ones that are imported into the U.S., you can keep an eye out for it's called the Protected Designation of Origin logo. And that does guarantee that the oils were produced, processed, and prepared in a specific region of the labeled country using the traditional production methods, meaning that they are made from olives that were pressed and had the oil extracted in the traditional way, rather than simply being bottled in the labeled country. So if you see that Protected Designation of Origin logo, for France, it's AOC, for example, then you know that those oils were actually prepared in the traditional proper way and that you're getting the real deal when you buy them.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Let's switch gears to another type of fat, triglycerides. You recently wrote about them. Mm-hmm. First, what are triglycerides? What do they do?
Triglycerides are those other fats in the blood. So we hear a lot about HDL and LDL cholesterol, but we don't hear as much about triglycerides. These are just another type of fat that circulates in the blood. They provide energy for the body. They're synthesized by the liver. They also come in part from some of the foods that we eat. But high triglyceride levels, like high cholesterol levels or high levels of bad LDL cholesterol, are also linked with a variety of poor health outcomes, mainly cardiovascular disease, but some other problems too.
How do you lower triglycerides if they're high?
Well, lifestyle changes sometimes are enough to do it. So what your doctor might first advise, if you have high triglycerides and they're not like super, super high, is losing weight, if you're overweight, limiting alcohol, doing moderate to intense exercise on a regular basis, making certain dietary changes like cutting sugars and other carbohydrates, which is really kind of interesting because it's actually the carbohydrates that play a bigger role in your triglyceride level than fat. If your levels are really high, there's actually a prescription fish oil called Lovaza that you may have seen advertised, and that is approved for people with very high triglyceride levels. That's a level of at least 500. So this is only approved for a certain population, but for people with very high triglycerides, you really need to get them down. That prescription fish oil pill is often prescribed by the doctor. And then if needed, a person can also take prescription drugs, mainly the statin drugs, which also lower cholesterol.
When it comes to triglycerides, is it a medication that you could go off as soon as you get them under control?
You know, that's a really good question. It probably varies a lot by person and depends on what kind of lifestyle habits the person has and if they're very overweight and have other risk factors. So that's something I couldn't really give advice on. You'd have to decide that on a case-by-case basis with your doctor. But often with these cardiovascular type risk factors, once they're under control, sometimes lifestyle changes enough or lifestyle changes alone are enough to maintain them, sometimes not.
Let's talk about sugar substitutes. We only have a few minutes, but I wanted to talk to artificial sweeteners. They're everywhere, sodas, fruit drinks, candies, coffee, everywhere. And, you know, there's real mixed bag of, responses when you ask, do they help? Can they help you lose weight?
Well, the evidence is all over the place.
Yeah.
This topic is just so interesting and so bizarre because it is so unclear what's going on when people are consuming a lot of these artificial sweeteners, like through diet beverages or other sources. So
diet beverages being probably the biggest one, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest supplier of artificial sweeteners in the diet. Definitely. So there are studies showing that when people use sugar substitutes instead of sugar, that it can help them lose weight. Although in the best study on this that looked at 15 randomized controlled clinical trials, the weight loss was small. It was about 2 pounds on average per person, although they also lost some body fat and some waist circumference. So it's not like huge amounts of weight loss, even when they have been found to help people lose weight. But then there's a whole bunch of studies that have found that there's really no difference in calorie intake over the course of a day when people drink artificially sweetened beverages or when they don't. So these studies kind of suggest that when people drink diet beverages, they simply compensate for those calorie savings by eating more at meals. And then there's even some research showing that people gain weight on average when they use a lot of sugar substitutes versus when people just drink sweetened beverages. Although it's, again, these are observational studies, so you can't really tease out whether it's actually the diet beverages that are causing the weight gain or that they are part of a certain health pattern of people that have other risk factors for gaining weight.
Jamie Coff, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Jamie Coff is a senior editor of the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.